Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
This message comes from NPR sponsor McCormick & Company, committed to enhancing people's health, their communities, and the planet. McCormick. Healthy, sustainable, delicious. For more, visit McCormickCorporation.com/futureofflavor.
Today, we're heading to the races. The U.S. has a rich motorsport history thanks to race series like NASCAR and IndyCar, just to name the big ones. But in the last few years, a certain sound has been getting louder and louder in America. To you gearheads, or petrolheads if you prefer, you recognize those sounds. Those are the sounds of Formula One.
And it's lights out and away we go! It's lights out and away we go! It's lights out and away we go! It's lights out!
The popularity of F1 races in the U.S. skyrocketed after Liberty Media bought Formula One in 2017. Netflix's Drive to Survive helped boost interest in the sport during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. The series has remained popular. F1 introduced two new races in the U.S., in Miami and Las Vegas, to the season calendar with the added speculation there may be more on the horizon. And while some Americans are just now starting to notice F1, some of you have been fans of the sport for a long time and are excited for the 2024 season.
My name's Andy Walgar. I've worked in Formula One racing for about 4 years of my life back in the late 90s, early 2000s, before moving to North Carolina. I think it's great for the nation. It's much like soccer, to be honest, and the Premier League finally building up speed here in this country. And personally, I don't see any downside to it, to be quite honest. I think it moves with the markets. That's how the sport works.
I just got back from the Saudi Grand Prix in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It was so much fun, really exciting and exhilarating and a spectacle. I grew up watching Formula One and NASCAR and motorcycle races with my dad on Sundays. I love how you can learn about cars and racing. There's also more drama than a K-drama.
So how does Formula One fit into America's legacy car racing scene? And what would it take for the U.S. to fully embrace the sport? You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. On your mark, get set, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then, just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Joining us now are Jonathan Clegg and Joshua Robinson. They're out with a new book about Formula One titled The Formula: How Rogues, Geniuses, and Speed Freaks Reengineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport. Jonathan Clegg is also a sports editor at The Wall Street Journal. John, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much.
And Josh Robinson is a sports reporter also at The Journal. Josh, great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And here in studio with me is Sarakshi Rai. She's a former Formula One reporter who was based in Dubai. She's now director of audience development and head of social media at The Hill. Sarakshi, thanks for being here with me.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the basics. Formula One as a sport, unlike most sports where humans come into contact with one another, contact is the last thing you want in F1 because that means a crash. John, can we start with you in terms of what makes Formula One a sport in the traditional sense of the definition?
Well, I mean, the sport boils down to the racing, obviously. 10 teams, 20 cars at the start line of every Grand Prix, and the race to see who makes the podium at the end is the sort of sports part. I think what separates F1 from many other sports is that the kind of sport dimension is just one part of what makes F1 such a kind of exciting proposition, because it's as much a sort of technological and engineering problem to be solved by the team, by the sort of hundreds of engineers and designers that make up every team. And it is also a sort of marketing exercise for the automotive giants like Ferrari and Mercedes, who make up the sort of roster of teams that compete in F1 every year. So, the sport part is definitely the most alluring dimension, but it also sort of adds on all those other components.
Right. Josh, when we think about that, what John's just saying there, how much do people see all those other components and just see the sport?
Well, I think that for decades, part of the problem that F1 had in terms of breaking through with new audiences was that you only saw the sort of what happened for 2 hours on a Sunday and the technological aspects, which were not, which represent kind of a high barrier to entry for a lot of people. The genius of F1 over the past few years, and that has coincided with the surge in popularity, is how F1 kind of developed all those other touch points for people. So yes, you might still be interested in the technical aspects. You might still be all about what happens for 2 hours on a Sunday. But with things like Netflix's Drive to Survive, people are now seeing all the other aspects. For instance, the fact that you've got this club of 20 generally good-looking, very rich drivers who are prepared to risk their lives going around at 200 miles per hour. And they happen to be drama queens, and there's a lot of backbiting and sniping. And so that drama component has really been ramped up in recent years, and that gives people more to latch onto.
So actually, what do you love about F1?
I love all of it. I love the drama. I love the little, like, team,
the good-looking drivers.
The good-looking drivers, definitely a draw. That's why I started watching it in 2001, because Kimi Raikkonen was, like, young and, good-looking, blonde hair, blue-eyed. I mean, he was a great racer, too. So, I mean, it has all of it. It has the suspense, the drama, the technical aspect of it. But you also have strategies involved. There's a lot of strategic thinking to how the teams go about, with different strategies on race day to, when they're qualifying or they're testing. And it's really, really insightful once you understand that, of course, because it is complicated, for a general audience that doesn't necessarily watch it often.
So let's start with helping everyone understand if they have not been delving into this world. NASCAR's roots can be traced back to the Prohibition era and bootlegging. And IndyCar, much like Formula One, was born post-World War II. So let's take a moment and consider the differences in the type of racing and why they matter. Let's start with the cars. Here's what a NASCAR sounds like. Here's what IndyCar sounds like. And here's F1 again. Josh, I have to say, F1 sounds the coolest to my ear. What are the differences between the cars in each of these series?
F1 is open wheel racing, so the cars look more like Indy than NASCAR. The engine specs change every 4 or 5 years, which is pretty amazing because this is really a sport that is, when we say Formula One, it refers to the Formula rule book, which is the set of specifications that defines the car in each era and kind of keeps up with the cutting edge of automotive technology. And every 4 or 5 years, when they do that, it turns the sport upside down because hundreds of people actually have to come up with a new way to interpret those rules, find the gray areas and the loopholes, and make a more competitive car than the rest of the field. And that's kind of what really sets F1 apart from any other motorsport. It is at the pinnacle of car development. And the budgets, you know, are now approaching $300 million for most teams. And, you know, they act as this, or it was always the idea that the F1 team would act as this super high-end R&D department for all these automotive giants. That's changing a little bit now, but, you know, this is still seen as the most complex technical challenge there is in motorsport.
As you all write about in the formula, you go into some of that. Can I ask you all about when it comes to tracks? There's a few Formula One circuits that have been added to the calendar, but venues like the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which is where the Indy 500 takes place, can host all three, NASCAR, IndyCar, and at one point even Formula One. So, John, what kind of elements go into the track circuit design for F1?
Well, the F1 tracks are all sort of remarkably different, actually. You have the sort of, you know, traditional European tracks. You know, the probably most famous F1 race of all is the Monaco Grand Prix. So there are a bunch of races that take place in the sort of heartland of Europe every year. But F1 has also was also really a sort of pioneer in pushing into new markets, you know, as far back as the sort of 70s and 80s. And so you have a string of races that take place in Asia, whole new series of races that take place in the Gulf and the Middle East. And now, as you mentioned at the top of the show, you know, the series is making a really concerted effort to push into North America and stage races in the North American time zone. So the tracks, you know, are scattered all over the world. And F1 tracks are basically split between those that are sort of street races that literally take place through the town. Monaco is one example of that. They also did that with Vegas this year, where they raced down the Las Vegas Strip on a Saturday night, had to shut down Las Vegas Boulevard to race down the actual street that regular cars drive down the rest of the time, and purpose-built tracks. And then the biggest difference between, obviously, NASCAR tracks and F1 tracks is that F1 tracks are, NASCAR tracks are sort of ovals, they go round and round, whereas F1 tracks are, you know, a series of straights and bends and hairpins and chicanes and, you know, require drivers to, you know, make multiple turns and straights and navigate what is much closer to, like you say, the sort of original street designs.
All right, we're going to head to a quick break, but when we come back, we hear from a fan who's built a community around F1.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message we got from one of you.
So this story is about 10 or 15 years old. I did go and see a Formula One Grand Prix at Silverstone in the UK. Lots of excitement. But it just didn't do much for me. The cars went round and round and round. I know it's some people's jam, and that's great, but it just didn't do much for me.
Unlike 1A's executive producer, Rupert Allman, who you just heard from there, our next guest says Formula One is his absolute favorite sport. Joining us now from Chicago is Ted Burks. Ted is a Formula One fan and organizer of the Chicago F1 Club. Hey, Ted, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Chicago's a huge sports town. Why is F1 your favorite sport over all the other teams you could be rooting for in Chicago?
It's funny you ask, because it's the only sport I actually watch on TV. I don't watch basketball, football, or baseball. I really only watch Formula One. It's my one and only sport. I've been watching it since 1975 when I saw on TV. They just showed like 15 minutes of the Monte Carlo Grand Prix, and I was hooked at that time. And you couldn't actually watch Formula One on TV in America at that time, so I had to read about it.
And now, of course, you've built a community around F1, organizing race-watching events around the city. I should point out most of those overseas races are in the early morning hours at like 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. How do you work around that?
Well, so most of the European races are at 8 p.m. or sorry, 8 a.m. So we're struggling to find some bars that will open up at that time. But now my group, which used to be only about 10 people, is about 150 people. So it's a little easier to convince some bars to open up early. But yeah, the late ones are difficult. I think Shanghai is at 2 a.m. in the morning, so that's got to find a bar with a 4 a.m. license, which is a little more of a challenge. But
Ted, is it harder to get the bars to open up than to get people to show up? Which one's a harder ask there?
Now it's a lot easier. Obviously, with Netflix, there's a whole new there's a whole new group of people that have become interested, obviously, in Formula One. So it's a lot easier than it was 10 years ago when I started organizing these events, thank God. So, so I have that kind of momentum going at the moment. So it's a little bit easier.
Josh, on a larger scale, how does the timing of these races affect viewership for F1 fans across the world? Because I imagine this is something people want to watch live.
Well, the traditional markets for Formula One on television have always been Europe and Asia. And so that kind of midday Sunday or early afternoon in Europe tends to work pretty well with Asia historically. But we're seeing a new move to kind of include the North American time zones in recent years, as this market is clearly the holy grail for any sports league. And so now in this season, we've got 24 races. Three of them are in the United States, but six, a full quarter of the calendar, are inconvenient time zones for North America. So it's the three U.S. races plus Canada, Mexico, and Brazil. And we saw there is still a needle to thread there to maximize audience. And we saw that with Las Vegas last November when the race started at midnight. And so that was to draw in more of a European audience as well, because if you don't have Europe, you're giving up on sort of your traditional viewership there.
So, actually, you were based in Dubai, which is currently a nighttime race. What are the benefits of nighttime racing in a place like Dubai? I imagine depends a lot on the time of year.
Well, the track is in Abu Dhabi, so it's like only a two-hour drive from Dubai, and it's beautiful. I mean, the track lights, you know, looking at it on the television, which is, you know, where most of the audiences watch the races, it just looks beautiful. It looks spiffy, fancy, you know, high-tech, and there's just a certain charm to the night races. I remember when Singapore launched their night race, I mean, it was the new big thing on the calendar to have a night race, and there was this new excitement that was, you know, built among the fans, because it was a novelty, right? Now we have a lot of night races on the circuit, but it is fun to have like a change, and it also changes how the drivers drive, how, you know, the track is set up, how you know, how late they go, and the time zone is like a huge factor in it, because, you know, I remember growing up in India, trying to watch a race that was in the US or Canada or Brazil, it was almost impossible to even find it on the television that late at night, you know.
John, I just wanted to ask, is that representative? Who's F1's primary demographic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the primary demographic for a long time was,
you know, basically middle-aged men who are like sort of really into science and technology. And I think that the sort of triumph of Liberty Media's ownership of F1 has been to really sort of expand that demographic to include not only many more younger fans, but also many more female fans, because they have shown huge growth in that area. And I think that is a lot to do with the fact that you know, as we discussed earlier, they've been able to market the sport as less a sort of exercise in, you know, technological precision and more the kind of suspense and human drama that comes from, you know, a cast of incredibly telegenic drivers constantly trying to get one over on each other. Certainly, you know, as the listener mentioned just earlier, I think the sort of most fascinating part of F1 is the fact that these teams are all operating under the same rules and with more or less nowadays the same budgets. And the real sort of difference between the teams, what separates the winners from the others, is which teams are able to identify the sort of gray areas in the rules, the loopholes in the rules, and exploit them. Exactly.
Ted, what kind of changes would you like to see for Formula One? And can I ask you, just to John's point, what's sort of the gender makeup of folks who are coming out to your club? Is it mostly men, mostly women, a mix?
It's now more of a mix. I mean, certainly when I started the group 10 years ago, it was mostly, you know, middle-aged men. Now, of course, we have the younger crowd, I think, really obviously due to the Netflix series.
What changes would you like to see to Formula One, Ted?
For me, I want to see two more teams. I'd like to see them prove Andretti to bring his team to Formula One. And then one other team, I think, would add some dynamic competition and some more drama on the track.
That was Ted Burks. Ted is a Formula One fan. He's also organizer of the Chicago F1 group. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
John, do people root for a team or for drivers? How does that work?
Yeah, that's one of the sort of other fascinating aspects of F1, because I'd say most fans root for drivers, right? The sort of classic model of F1, you know, fandom is you root for the driver from your country. And certainly we've seen over the years many, many times that whole countries have been turned on to the sport and have become, you know, F1, you know, addicts purely on the basis of one, you know, world-class driver emerging from their home country and really putting F1 on the map there. We saw this with the great German driver Michael Schumacher, who sort of almost single-handedly, you know, made F1 a huge hit in Germany. Fernando Alonso, who we discussed earlier, really turned Spain onto F1. The one exception for that is Italy, which they Italian fans universally root for Ferrari, regardless of which nationality their drivers are. And that is the closest thing to the sort of the home team that exists in F1. Most of the other teams, even though they may represent countries from across the world, Red Bull is obviously an Austrian company, but they are all basically based in the UK.
Josh, we have been talking about Lewis Hamilton. We've mentioned him a few times. One of the biggest bombshells from the offseason was his move from Mercedes to Ferrari. To John's point, how did Italian fans react to that?
I mean, Italian fans are always super excited to have, you know, they believe that Ferrari needs to have the best drivers, that there is a kind of divine right to win when you drive that red car. It hasn't happened in a little while, but with Lewis Hamilton, a proven seven-time world champion, coming over, you know, and the idea that there's a new set of specs coming for the cars in 2026 that could reshuffle the pack a little bit, I think a lot of fans think this is finally Ferrari's moment to have the right combination of car and elite driver to put them back on the top step of the podium.
And of course, the last Formula One champion was 2007 with Kimi Raikkonen for Ferrari, right? So it's been a very long time. I mean, they've had only one race winner in the last season, being Carlos Sainz, the guy there, you know, they've kind of pushed off for Lewis Hamilton. So it's really interesting for the Tifosi, given how emotionally involved they are, right?
John, can I ask you about something that you all talk about in the formula, which is just something that you all were alluding to earlier, like the technology here in the cars. Can you just sort of explain the difference between like the technology of a team behind Mercedes versus Ferrari?
Yeah, so I mean, F1, you know, really since the sort of late 70s and early 80s, went from being a sort of, you know, sort of quite amateurish sport in which, you know, guys could sort of tool around in their garage and produce race-winning machines, to what is something much closer to sort of the aerospace engineering that they're doing at NASA, right? It's a sort of aerodynamic challenge, and aerodynamics is the single biggest differentiator between the teams. So that sort of manifests itself usually in the sort of car design aspect. And it's really those sorts of, you know, minute changes to the shape of the car that can have huge impact on the aerodynamics of the car. And the thing that's the reason that aerodynamics is so important is because F1 cars actually are not the fastest cars in any motorsport. Indy cars are faster in a straight line. What separates F1 cars from everyone else is that they corner much, much faster than any other car. So even though an Indy car is actually faster in a straight line, an F1 car would leave an Indy car in the dust if they raced around an F1 track, because they're so fast at going around corners. And it's that sort of hunt for the latest sort of aerodynamic advantage that your team spend these hundreds of millions of dollars pursuing, you know, late into the winter, and then unveil at preseason testing. And that's when we get the first glimpse of the new car designs and start to get a sense of which cars are going to be at the front.
Well, we're going to make a pit stop here. Still ahead, we discuss what's ahead for Formula One and women's stake in the male-dominated sport.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message we got from one of you. Growing up, I used to watch F1 with my grandfather, and I loved it. But the fact that I learned how many teams are sponsored by oil companies, I stopped watching it after 2005. I feel bad that many of the cities around the world that host the races have serious economic problems, which only get exacerbated by F1's presence. Seeing housing affordability and income inequality are some of the few problems that cities like Austin, Miami, and Las Vegas have had to confront. Josh, can I ask you to address John's comment about the environmental impact and what the sport has done to address that?
So F1 absolutely knows that this is an issue that it needs to solve in the next few years. And they've committed to a plan they call Net Zero 2030 to offset the emissions completely by that time. And what's interesting about the whole environmental question in F1 is that the emissions really aren't generated that much by the cars themselves. You know, they're only on track at any given, you know, on any given weekend for under 6 hours. What really is the question that F1 needs to address is the moving around of this circus to, you know, nearly two dozen countries every season. Because every team moves the cars, moves hundreds of people at a time. And that travel as they, exactly, is, you know, and a lot of private jets too. So these are the questions that they need to address. And, you know, they have reworked the calendar a little bit to make some of those transfers a little less crazy so that they're not going Japan to Mexico to Europe and back to Asia. But it's still something that they need to work on and that they say they are addressing over the next 5 to 10 years.
So we were just talking about the environmental cost. I also wanted to bring up the actual cost. We got a message from Frank who said, as a 50-plus-year-old who remembers seeing Ayrton pass away, I don't want to be accused of gatekeeping, but the only downside of the Drive to Survive fans is that I can no longer afford to go to races here in the U.S. He's talking about when he went to the U.S. Grand Prix with his son in 2007 and said it only cost $150. That's no longer the case. Here's a message we got from Anthony in Indiana.
I knew nothing about F1 before going to the 2000 U.S. Grand Prix in Indianapolis. but I was instantly hooked by the sound of the 3-liter V10 engines running at 20,000 RPM. I went to the next 7 U.S. Grand Prix with my father. We continued to watch most races from home, and in recent years, along with my sons. I would love for all 4 of us to go to a race, but while tickets were $100 each 20 years ago, they are now easily $1,000 each.
Sirakshi, I was just reading in this morning's Miami Herald about the results of an ethics investigation into Miami Mayor Francis Suarez accepting an F1 ticket package that cost $10,000 from billionaire Ken Griffin, which I should note he paid back after the Miami Herald asked him about it. That's a whole other conversation. But is that really how much these tickets cost?
Well, right now they do. I mean, if you look at the Las Vegas prices and the Miami prices, it's through the roof. And I remember growing up in India, a Formula One experience was out of the question just because of the exchange rate. And I remember going to the inaugural Delhi Grand Prix, and it was a lot of money. It was, you know, a very select few people who could afford to go. And I remember, you know, my first ever Formula One race was for my 16th birthday when my parents scrounged up enough cash to take my family on our first international trip from India. And we went to Spain, actually. It was a race that Fernando Alonso did win. And it was the best experience of my life. I was 16. I was a huge fan. But the only reason we could afford to go is because my parents knew someone who knew someone who worked at the Force India team who gave us free tickets for some obscure stand on like turn 13 where, you know, you could see the cars go by once every couple of minutes. And that's, I think, the larger issue that F1 needs to address is like the accessibility of it. You know, in Europe, at least, when we went to Spain, and this is, you know, almost 15 years ago, I remember a lot of Europeans would get into the car and they'd be like, oh, from Spain, we're going to Germany, we're going to Spa, we're going to, you know, we're going to try and make it all the way to Italy. And because it was cheap, they could get, you know, a ticket for a grassy hill, pitch up a tent, sit and watch the race for 3 days. And that was affordable. But now it is really expensive. I mean, just look at the Las Vegas tickets. I tried to inquire for ticket prices and I was told it's, you know, experience tickets and it would cost anywhere from $5,000 to $12,000.
Yeah, so I was talking to my cousin about this. I had some family in Trinidad that wanted to come and they were talking about $30,000 to go to Vegas. John, can you comment on this a little bit in terms of the sport and the cost and how much of a barrier that is? Does this just become something that people watch on TV? Is that what they're going for?
Yeah, I mean, it's, your listener who said that they remember paying $100 for a ticket to the US Grand Prix. Nowadays, $100 would literally not get you a baseball cap at the Las Vegas Grand Prix. I'm not even joking. The prices they charge for merchandise are
almost as ludicrous as they charge.
You know, T-shirt, McLaren T-shirt, or whatever, is like $350. Not to mention the concessions. You know, there was the infamous $375 lobster roll at the Miami Grand Prix. It's completely ludicrous. The prices are out of control. You know, one of the things that F1 has really had to sort of, juggle is that it is a series and a sport that is absolutely wrapped up with the idea of exclusivity, luxury. The whole sport kind of loves to play on this idea that you are going behind the velvet rope when you attend a Grand Prix and you're part of a special club. You know, part of its whole, one of the great successes of F1 was its sort of development of the so-called paddock club, the special VIP section. That's where you want to see and, you know, be seen and where the A-list stars rub shoulders with, you know, the celebrities. It's traded off that idea for so long that I think, there's a part of the whole sort of culture of F1 that's now so inextricably wrapped up with that idea that every single part of it feels like it has to be, you know, exclusive, and exclusive invariably means expensive, when the reality is, as we discussed earlier, F1 used to be much more of a sort of balance, right? You used to have the races, like the glitzy races like Monaco in Monte Carlo, but you would also have races where fans would pitch up in their RVs and it would be much more like a sort of music festival feel. And I feel that one of the things that Liberty will probably have to think about soon is whether it can continue sort of trying to recreate a series of sort of high-end glamorous races here without also offering something at the other end for the fans who would prefer that other type of experience.
Josh, how do teams make money in Formula One? Do they get a cut of these ticket sales, I imagine?
They do. They get a cut in prize money from the organizers, but also their business plan is what you see plastered all over the car. It's the sponsors that number in the dozens and sometimes hundreds for teams, you know, breaking down to even, you know, can you carve out a little piece of the wing and stick a logo on there? That's really what drives the enormous influx of money into the sport, and what allows them to spend so much on not only the, you know, the running of the team and the development of the cars, which, you know, is approaches $200 million, which is where the cost cap is right now, but also paying the drivers. Someone like Lewis Hamilton is on, you know, makes a salary that's on par with the biggest stars in the NBA, and that money has to come from somewhere. And so TV rights, the share they get from Liberty, and everything you see plastered all over the car.
Let's go to another message from one of you.
Hi, my name is John Steele, and I'm originally from Indianapolis, Indiana, which is the home of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Because of that, I was lucky from a young age. I was exposed to racing in person, including Formula One, and I've been an avid fan since about the mid-2000s. I'm most looking forward to the growth of American racing in Formula One. Andretti Racing, a powerhouse team with success all over the place, and not just IndyCar, but all over, is also attempting to join Formula One with Cadillac in 2028. So all in all, I'm excited for the growth of not just Formula One, but all auto racing in the U.S.
Thanks to John for that message. We also just got this from Lucia, who said, one of my best childhood memories is watching Formula One with my older brother in Peru. We had this small black and white TV. Every Sunday, the noise of the cars brought us together. It was so exciting. Sarakshi, we have mentioned this earlier in the hour that this is a very male-dominated sport. How has the role of women evolved in F1 through the decades?
It's always been fascinating that this is a question that has been the topic of conversation since I first started reporting on Formula One as a 20-year-old, you know. It's always, you know, there are so many fans that want to be included, but traditionally they weren't. You know, I remember being the only person, only woman in a very male-dominated group of people. Like, I remember being on the Formula One racetrack in Delhi, being a reporter, and, you know, it was mostly male journalists. And, you know, you had Jenny Gao of the BBC, who, you know, was a fixture on the track. But now you see a lot more female representation, both, you know, in the technical garages, as well as, you know, in terms of the forward-facing roles. You know, the PR and comms professionals are women in the teams. You know, a few of the team principals have been women, not anymore, but in previous years, you know, you've seen.
And what about drivers?
Well, we've not had a female driver in Formula One, at least not, you know, someone who's not been just on the testing side of things. And that's still something that a lot of women fans want. A couple of years ago, I spoke to an F2 driver, Tatiana Calderon, and she was in Formula 2, and she was attempting to break into Formula 1. And her,
it's like the minor leagues.
Yeah. That's right. That's like the one level below Formula 1. It's where most of the Formula 1 drivers, you know, come through the ranks. And she would talk about how there is this inherent sexism, you know, where she would be told that she's not strong enough to be a Formula 1 driver because of her sex, you know, and that's something I think that women drivers in Formula One will continue to face. But interestingly, there was a billboard in Times Square with the Red Bull racing team featuring their woman F1 Academy racer just this week on Times Square's billboard. So I think the sport is trying to change, and it will take a while, but I hope we see it before, you know, I'm old and gray. That is a hope.
All right. Well, that's your hope. Now, I just want to end the hour. We know the season has started. The next race is March 24th in Melbourne. Josh, what should we be watching out for here? What are you most excited about for this season?
Well, I mean, it's been an era of Red Bull dominance with Max Verstappen over the past couple of years. And, I mean, one of the questions, we're only three races into the season, is already, is Max Verstappen going to win every race? It's not out of the question. You know, the longest season ever with 24 races could also see Red Bull sweep nearly all of them, if not all of them. They were just one shy last year. The only exception was Singapore, when Carlos Sainz won with his Ferrari. But the battle behind Max Verstappen is getting closer, and that's good news for the competitive side of F1. And, you know, the battle to be the sort of second, third, and fourth teams is wide open.
John, I've learned a lot in this hour about Formula One. Give me one more tidbit to make me sound smart if I need to talk about this at some point in time.
Well, you can never go wrong talking about F1 if you mention Ferrari. So, you know, the most iconic race team in F1. For most of the last few years, unfortunately, a complete catastrophe when it comes to winning championships. Ferrari is the team that can't get out of its own way most of the time. And but we're starting to see some signs that maybe things are moving in the right direction. As we discussed earlier, the forthcoming move of Lewis Hamilton to Ferrari, maybe that's the thing that puts the prancing horse back on top. So anytime you can discuss Ferrari in terms of F1, you're doing well.
Sir, actually, one last note from you. What are you most excited about for the season?
Well, I'm excited to see more racing. I mean, look, take number one out of the equation. I think, you know, as everyone said, it's going to be really fascinating to see who comes in second place. And I think that's what's going to make the sport fun. I really want Carlos Sainz to get a drive for the next year as well. I mean, he's kind of, you know, thrown out of the loop with the Lewis Hamilton news. And I just want, it'll be interesting to see the new races on the calendar this year.
That's Sarakshi Rai. She's a former Formula One reporter based in Dubai, now director of audience development at The Hill. Thanks to Jonathan Clegg and Josh Robinson. Their new book, The Formula, How Rogues, Geniuses, and Speed Freaks Reengineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport, is out now. Jonathan's also a sports editor at The Wall Street Journal, and Josh is a sports reporter also at The Journal. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Nyla Boodoo of Axios. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot, so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This advertisement comes from our paid sponsor, Fundrise. High interest rates mean that real estate assets are available at a discount compared to previous valuations. The Fundrise flagship fund plans to expand its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. Add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio at fundrise.com/NPR. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund before investing. Read the prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.